connection to our community matters. Local radio is the link. When you tune in wherever you are, you're part of a conversation that makes us all stronger. But local stations aren't getting the support they deserve from the government. Your support is vital. We're asking you to support the Community Radio Initiative. Write the government. Tell them how important this station is. MyCRI.ca is the place to get all the information so we can work together to make a difference. MyCRI.ca.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you the best for the new year.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning and welcome to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples. In today's episode, we're bringing you another interview recorded by Iago, our public affairs work study. He sat down with Hailin Wang, a remarkable advocate for sustainability, to discuss her experiences at COP28 and her vision for COP29. They dive into her work engaging students in sustainability efforts, exploring how young voices are shaping climate action on the world stage and right here in our communities. Without further ado, here's their conversation.
Hi everyone, my name is Iago, and today we're diving into the world of climate finance, a little bit of innovation with a very special guest, Hailin Wang. Is that how I say your name?
Hailin Wang.
Wang. Okay, yeah. So Hailin Wang. Hailin is an undergraduate student in actuarial science at Simon Fraser University and a passionate advocate for building financial resilience against natural disaster in this age of climate change. She's been to the Conference of the Parts number 28, and she's been engaged with global initiatives like the Global Shield Insular Resilience Partnership. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's actually such a pleasure. I'm so interested. And I know a little bit about you, but I bet that no one hearing necessarily know anything about you. So please introduce a little bit of yourself.
Well, I'm just your everyday student. I'm currently interning and I'm trying to juggle between having a good work-life balance and learning more about actuarial science during my work term. I currently am interning at this insurance company called Intact, and most of what we do is property and casualty insurance. So a lot of that has to do with like insuring your home against a disaster or insuring like a commercial building against disaster. So I think I am also learning a lot about the climate crisis through my current internship. Personally, I have a lot of hobbies. I am currently trying to become a better tennis player. I love watching the Australia Open, the US Open, and I love copying their moves on the court. I love to play music. I play this Chinese traditional instrument called the pipa, which I haven't played in a while, but I need to improve myself there. And the remainder of my time, I'm just trying to stay healthy and stay active and, yeah, maintain good work-life balance.
That's actually so interesting. I mean, it's really hard to put all that through. And I mean, it's a thing that the earlier you learn how to, I'm referring to the work-life balance, the best chance you have to have a healthy life and be happy. I think so.
Yeah. No, I think like even with students, if you're staring at your laptop all day, you're not going to be happy, right? Like you need to go out and I think just be active. Like it makes your brain happier.
And do you have any specific moves? The one specific that you like from the openings on tennis that you like?
Oh, my favorite player is Rybakina. So she's a women's singles She used to be the Wimbledon champion. I think it was in 2022. I think she's from Kazakhstan. I'm not too sure, but I love her. I love her moves. So she has this one specific move where whenever she's trying to run after a ball, and you know, it's like a singles game, it's just her and the court is like really big, right? So for her to be able to reach an incoming tennis ball, maybe that's like far away, she would move her feet in that direction, but then like she would hold out her hand, all like her arms would always be straight, and so she would be moving just like with her tennis with like just at like a 90 degree angle. And at first I thought, oh, it looks so silly, why would she do that? But then when I'm like learning it with my coach, I learned, oh, like it actually preps you to for the swing like immediately when you reach the ball. So it's actually a very helpful tip.
Yeah, I just wish everyone could see what I'm seeing now. It's such a good interpretation. Are you into theater as well?
Sorry?
Are you into like theater and plays? Theater, like, yeah, theater plays.
I'm not that exposed to it.
Yeah, no, it's fair. I'm just kidding, because it's a good interpretation of the tennis play move. Well, let me move to what I'm here for, that is learning a little bit more on your passion for environmentalism, a little bit of your local engagement and your personal journey. So, first of all, do you have any specifics on how you start like going around the issue of environmentalism? Anything as a kid, anything as a teenager that sparked your attention and like moved you into this direction?
I probably will have to begin with my childhood. So I was born in China, and I actually lived like half of my childhood life in China. And when I moved to Canada, I experienced this really big, I think, just personal mental crisis, I would say, where I didn't feel like I belonged in either country in a way. Like I was still, I think I wasn't that fluent in Chinese and I wasn't that fluent in English. And I just felt very lost a lot of the times. Like I wasn't Chinese, I wasn't Canadian. It wasn't until I think I reached when I studied in Toronto, and then I got exposure to the climate movement, that I kind of found a sense of personal identity that way, because I was so lost culturally. And I think I really found myself in that space where everyone was quite multicultural and very inclusive. And I think it became a passion for me, because I was able to engage with my Chinese relatives, my Chinese friends, for example, who were not that welcoming to the concept of Western environmentalism or like Western conservation. Because a lot of times I think coming from developing countries, we tend to think of like conservation as, or like just lowering emissions as bad for the economy. And a lot of times people, my relatives would tell me, you know, why are you so brainwashed? Or like, why? It's just like, it's a very Western mindset. That's not how things work in China. And I think my passion really lied in being able to, I don't want to say educate Chinese people, because they have their own personal views of what environmentalism is. I think is I want to be able to bridge this multicultural view of like Chinese and Western environmentalism together. Because in my personal journey, like I've met so many of my Chinese friends and Chinese youth who are indeed really passionate about solving the climate crisis, but it's not really through what we know as like using less plastic or like using like recycling more. It's in a whole other way, like whole other political thoughts. So I think I really want to be able to bridge this cultural gap between Chinese people and a lot of what I've seen from Canadian people. So yeah, my passion, as I would say, really lies in like solving this multicultural issue in the environmental space.
And I just want to say that you're higher if it was up to me right now. Great elevator pitch, but aside from that, beautiful history, to be honest. It's so cool to see. I think, first of all, like an intergenerational approach, you see. Mm-hmm. I think there is a difference in how, of course, generations see the problem of climate change. And I think that building that up with cultural-wise education, if I may use the same like kind of speech that you were saying, it's really cool. It's really interesting to see. Like, it's not something I had ever approached. So, well, thank you for sharing.
I'm sure you've probably noticed. I think even within Vancouver, like after you've attended so many of like these environmental networking events or like these youth climate events, you kind of notice that a lot of people who do participate in these spaces, like they're fluent English speakers, even if they're foreigners, like they're very familiar with Western culture. Whereas I personally do know a lot of like my Chinese friends who are passionate about climate change. They're passionate about climate action, but because they might not speak English very well, or they might not be very extroverted or like participate in activism, because activism still is like very scandalous in Chinese culture. So they tend to abstain from those events, and then we never see people like that. So I think I really want to be able to bridge that gap in any way if I could, by like solving this language or cultural issue that's present in the space.
And how did you go from this space in Toronto to your engagement in Vancouver with, if I'm not wrong, City Hive and Youth Climate Innovation Lab?
No, I moved to Vancouver because I was working for the Nature Conservancy of Canada. I moved here for that job, but then I started attending SFU, so I left that job in a year. But yeah, I started exploring like the Vancouver climate space, and I really wanted to be able to understand, I guess, just engage more in like the Pacific Northwest culture. So that's why I started to get into City Hive. But I think even back then, I kind of noticed this issue where there weren't a lot of like Chinese people in those climate events, and even less like, I guess, just if I did meet other Chinese people, it was people who spoke like very fluent English, or people who were very culturally like Westernized. So I didn't see people that that I think are more like the people that I know in my childhood. So again, like that highlights the disparity I was talking about.
Okay. And specifically, if I may ask, because it's pretty interesting, at City Hive, what was exactly your role at City Hive?
It was a lab. So they had, I think, around 50, or was it like 40 to 50 just young people? So you could be a student, you could be a young professional, you could be working, as long as you were interested in advancing climate action in the city, you could participate, and then you will work together as a group to help specific organizations within Vancouver to solve a climate question that this organization came up with. For my group specifically, it was about the social cost of carbon. So we're trying to quantify, again, this is kind of tied to actuarial science. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to quantify the cost of damages maybe like 70 or 80 years into the future. And then we're trying to bring back that cost to the present in order to say that if you pay for this damage now, it's actually cheaper than if you were to pay for it 70 to 80 years later, right? Because of simple compound interest. So that's the social cost of carbon.
Nice. And I'm guessing that's one of the things that led you to start thinking about attending the Conference of the Parts. or is it directly connected?
Well, at that time, I already applied for,
oh, nice,
to attend COP28, but it definitely contributed to it because I was already studying actuarial science, so I was getting a lot of encouragement from my professors who were really interested in the fact that I was interested in climate action and also interested in insurance. And they thought that, oh, like, it would be great if you could go to this conference and learn more about compensation for countries that are suffering from damages after big disasters, or like vulnerable communities who have suffered from financial damages after big disasters. So I think it was a coincidence that I got such a cool project, but it really helped me in my learning.
And I think that the only gap I'm seeing right now is understanding where does your passion for environmentalism intersects with the question of actuarial science itself. Mm-hmm. So when did it begin? How did your approach to the Chinese participation in environmentalism led you to that?
I would say these are two separate interests.
Ooh, nice.
I would still like really like to pursue that multicultural initiative if I could sometime in the future. But what really led to my interest in actuarial science is because of its applicability. I wouldn't say that anyone really has a passion, I think, for quote unquote insurance, because it's not like it's not a very glamorous topic, and a lot of the times it has very negative connotations. But just to explain what actuarial science is, it's just we are trying to assign a cost to a future risk that will happen, and that risk could be anything. This risk could be, for example, losing your job or dying or having a disease, or even, you know, losing your car due to theft. And it could also be hurricanes, wildfires, and flooding. And for me, I was really interested in the physical damages part of insurance, like how much can we compensate someone after they lose their home, or how can we really build resiliency against these physical damages? And that really is inherently what insurance is. And it has been, it really is the oldest, I would say, product alive, because you could see when you read through history, I think people in ancient Greece have been using insurance to ensure that their exports are not lost while they're shipping them, right? So I think as I've learned more through my current courses and my current internship, I've realized that being an actuary is actually a very powerful advocate for climate action. Just to say what's currently happening in Canada, for example, the company I'm currently working in actually lost, I think, around $1 billion this year due to disasters that happened in Canada. I mean, we had the wildfires, and we had the hailstorms, and we had the floodings. So this really all adds up to a lot of people. And with more frequent disasters, I think more Canadians are going to experience more losses. And if you don't own private insurance, really, if you think about it, when you lose your home, you're going to lose everything. You're going to experience bankruptcy. So actually, a lot of actuaries have formulated this advocacy plan where they have lobbied the government for a long time to be able to implement this program called the National Affordable Flood Insurance Program, which is going to be implemented sometime, hopefully in 2025, so that insurers really... that all Canadians, no matter their income level, as long as you live somewhere, and if it gets flooded, you're going to get compensation for it from the government. And the premiums for this insurance will come from tax collection. So I think that's a really interesting way to deal with the climate crisis, right? And actuaries were really in this whole plan all along. So I think that's been really cool. And future developments, I think even when I was at COP28, I learned a lot about how actuaries could, they could formulate insurance products for governments like Tuvalu or Palau, and then they could insure, they made this product called the parametric insurance. So for example, on the island of Palau, if they get hit by a major hurricane or major cyclone, which always happens, immediately, as long as a sensor detects that this event has happened, money will go to those, like the government, immediately, so that the communities can be compensated right away. So they don't have like claims adjusters and, you know, all these middlemen coming through. Like it, the money gets delivered right away. And I think this could be such a powerful mechanism for like the loss and damage fund and like the green climate fund, if that could happen. So yeah, I really love to follow news in this space.
Well, I can see why. It is actually quite complicated, though. I imagine how this immediate response works and the like the policy to actually put in motion, right? Because it's like moving money from the budgeting. It's probably one of the hardest things you can try to do in politics.
Especially in the current political climate, I don't know how feasible like the National Flood Insurance Program is going to be, but it is a very cool plan. And I would say like the advocacy process for that plan has been going on for a long time, and hopefully we get to see it implemented next year.
Fingers crossed for that, please.
Yeah.
Well, if you let me move on, kind of, you've mentioned this as something you've learned in the Conference of Parts. And I just want to ask you a general question on how was your experience? How was attending over there? Any standout moments, key takeaways, anything you want to bring us on how it is to be in such a large conference lobbying and discussing multiple issues with multiple people?
Mm-hmm. So as I am like Chinese Canadian, I think the biggest advantage I had was being able to, for example, go to the China Pavilion and talk to the youth there and talk to the people there, and then go to the Canadian Pavilion and listen to stories about Indigenous-led advocacy and Indigenous-led conservation, and then listening to, like, being able to, I think, be exposed to both of these cultures was really fun for me. And then also being able to explore other countries' pavilions and talk to people from all around the world was such, you know, such a cool experience. But I would say my biggest learning probably is within, again, the insurance space, because I attended so many events where it was about building like a blue bond economy or so. That was where I learned about like the Palau insurance scheme. And then, I would say that's probably my biggest learning. And yeah, back to what I talked about with parametric insurance, how there's no middleman there. And like when a disaster strikes, you get money right away. And I remember learning about how even in those products, for example, you get the participation of like artificial intelligence and of tech, because a lot of the times if we can use, for example, blockchain to administer these funds to countries and then not go through a central bank or a central administrator, that would also eliminate a lot more corruption and a lot more, you know, like the nitty-gritty that happens in politics when it comes to moving funds. So there's so many innovative products that you learn about within COP, but I'm not sure how feasible it is when it comes to actual implementation. And then it kind of goes into, I guess, the bad things I've learned at COP is the number one disappointment I kind of had is I realized that politicians don't really know what exactly they're doing. I mean, they're just everyday humans, just like the rest of us. Because when I watch people, like, for example, John Kerry on the news, I tend to think, wow, like, he's such an experienced diplomat. Like, he probably would know how to solve the climate crisis right away. But when you see these people actually negotiating in the final conference room, and then him talking, and then China talking, and you kind of realize that everyone's just trying to push and pull and trying to kind of come to the best solution, but no one really knows exactly how the climate crisis is going to be solved. And I think the final result, even of COP28, where they were pledging that they would phase out fossil fuels, no, phase down fossil fuels, not necessarily phase out, the wording of that was also very controversial. So I think my biggest letdown was just knowing that we can't necessarily trust this whole process to 100% be feasible in the real world. And also that politicians don't exactly know what they're doing, no matter how many years of experience they've had.
I was trying to look, because I am pretty sure there is a say that the best politician will be a philosopher politician. It's something from the old Greeks. I could not find it right now. But I think it speaks a lot to what you're saying, actually. Yeah, they are everyday men who needs a lot more information to make the decisions they are actually making, but that the access is not easy and sometimes not what they want, because the power display and the power dispute is what is actually happening over there. It's like, who's pulling the strongest to push their interests forward. So it's about who has the greatest power decision and not necessarily the best decision itself. Yeah. And then it's hard to be guided by informed decisions when you're actually being pushed by other interests than actual the solution necessarily. Well, I think this is a really great start. I mean, in the sense of knowing about the Conference of the Parties, it's so cool to know how much stuff you can do there over there. Is there any particular information you can, like, quickly bring, explain, like, so you attend conferences and then you, like, you talk to these people? Do you lobby for them in any reason? What is your, as a undergraduate, what was your role?
Well, I would say as an SFU student, we don't hold political views when going into these conferences. And that's usually for safety reasons. I think mostly for me, I was there to learn. The one big task I had, and I forgot to mention this, was I was posting on SFU's Instagram. I was doing Instagram stories constantly throughout my whole week there. So I made this series called Climate Career Corner, where I was trying to, I interviewed different people basically that I met at the conferences or I met during talks, and then I would try to ask them about how exactly does their interest align with solving climate change, and then what advice they can give to people in their field to also become climate activists. And I remember this one lady that I met who was really cool. She was actually an SFU grad. And her name was Courtney Howard. I'm pretty sure, I don't know if you guys know her that thoroughly, but she graduated a while ago and then she went to medical school. I think it was somewhere in Quebec. She went to medical school, she became a doctor, and then eventually she's now an emergency physician all the way up north in Canada. And then in her spare time, she's doing like mental health work with people who suffer from wildfire anxiety. And I thought, you know, that was so cool. Like, you can, for example, if you're really passionate about health, you can also incorporate that with solving the climate crisis, because really, I think any job now could be a climate job if you find a way to connect it with climate action. With like Dr. Howard, I think her job was super inspirational. And then I also met lawyers who were also climate activists who were fighting on behalf of children and youths who have suffered from climate anxiety, and then they were able to sue Shell in, I think it was in